Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young, broadcasting today from WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida, as part of our election road trip. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Robin. We're following breaking news today, though, about suspicious packages that were addressed to former President Barack Obama, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. The Secret Service says agents intercepted the packages containing possible explosive devices early today and late yesterday. The Time Warner Center in New York City, where CNN is headquartered, was evacuated this morning after police were called about another suspicious package found there. The network shifted its broadcast to Washington, and here anchor Poppy Harlow on the air after being evacuated from the Time Warner Center in New York.
So, Renee, I will just tell you that we are outside safely. All of our CNN colleagues that we know of are outside right now. Everyone is safe, as we can see. And to catch our viewers up, about just a few 10 minutes ago, we heard the fire alarm go off while we were anchoring the show reporting on these explosive devices.
CNN reports the package sent to its New York headquarters was addressed to former CIA Director John Brennan. The White House issued a statement condemning what it called terrorizing acts. Joining us now for the latest is NPR's Brian Naylor. Brian, what more can you tell us about what the Secret Service is saying about these suspicious packages?
Hi, Jeremy. Well, the Secret Service is saying basically what you reported, that they intercepted two suspicious packages, one late yesterday addressed to former First Lady Hillary Clinton at her or addressed to her Chappaqua, New York home. And then early this morning, a second package addressed to former President Obama was intercepted here in Washington. They were identified during routine mail screening procedures, the service says, as potential explosive devices and were appropriately handled as such. The protectees did not receive the packages, nor were they at risk of receiving them. The mail for the former president, both former President Obama, former President Clinton, is screened at off-site facilities, one up in Westchester and one in Washington here, and that's apparently where the devices were intercepted.
Do we know if there were bombs in all of these packages?
Yeah, that's what the Secret Service is saying, that they were explosive devices in these packages. It's not clear exactly the nature of the devices, but there have been reports that they're pipe bombs.
But we also are hearing that neither former President Obama or Secretary Clinton were at risk at any point because of this.
That's right, because they screen the devices they screen the mail for the former presidents away from their homes, and so it wasn't as if they were found in their doorstep or in their mailboxes.
Is there any indication that this is linked to the explosive device found yesterday or earlier this week, rather, at the compound of George Soros, the billionaire who supports liberal causes?
Right. Well, law enforcement officials say, yes, there are indications. The package sent to Soros, which was apparently in his mailbox, is linked or is similar to the ones that that were sent to former President Obama and Mrs. Clinton. There is another. We talked about the CNN bombing, the device that was intercepted on its way to CNN. It was addressed to former CIA Director John Brennan, who's been a mm-hmm. frequent critic of President Trump, according to what CNN is reporting.
So we've got two former Democratic presidents or a presidential candidate in the case of Hillary Clinton, CNN. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the Democratic representative as well, she got one of these. And we're just seeing a tweet from the San Diego Union Tribune, their official account, saying that their staff and others were evacuated after a suspicious package was spotted there.
Yeah, there is. I don't, you know, it's far too early to say if this is the work of one individual or if others are involved. It's fair to say that Wasserman Schultz, along with Brennan, along with George Soros, Hillary Clinton, have all been targets of the Republican, the Trump administration, or I should say President Trump, at his rallies. We're all familiar with the kinds of lock her up chants and the targeting of CNN in particular. But it's impossible to say at this point whether, what the motivation is behind these devices.
Right. Well, we will continue to follow this news. And again, this is just coming in. We're still trying to confirm what's true and what's not, what's linked and what's not. But Brian Naylor in Washington, thank you.
All right, Jeremy, thanks.
Well, again, I'm in Florida ahead of the midterm elections. On Election Day, efforts to do away with or reform gerrymandering will appear on ballots in four states. They are Michigan, Missouri, Utah, and Colorado. And they follow Ohio, where lawmakers put a measure to curb partisan manipulation of congressional districts on the ballot for that state's May primary, and voters approved it by a large margin. It's unusual for so many states to deal with gerrymandering ballot measures. Only five had taken up the issue over the entire last decade. Ray Allen Bischel from member station KUNC reports on how end gerrymandering campaigns are playing out in two western states, Utah and Colorado.
Aside from an exceptional amount of pigeon poop, this street corner in Denver looks totally normal, deceptively normal.
There are buses crossing, there are cars zooming by.
That's Amanda Gonzalez, and she knows something that the people waiting to cross the street don't. That when they step off this curb, they're walking the plank, crossing an invisible precipice.
The invisible line isn't discernible from any other place on this corner.
It's the line that separates a state voting district represented by one politician from a district represented by another politician. And people don't seem to give a pigeon poop about these lines.
Hi, did you know that you're standing on the line between District 31 and 34?
Doesn't make any difference to me, sorry.
Nope, never really concerned me. Just crossing Colfax Broadway.
These lines are everywhere, crisscrossing the country through cities and fields, sometimes cutting right between neighboring homes in a gated community. And Gonzalez says they're really important.
Absolutely.
Gonzalez is the executive director of Colorado Common Cause. It's one of many groups backing a measure in Colorado that wants to drastically change who draws those lines.
Hopefully, after November, the people drawing that line will be people just like you and me. Right now, it's largely politicians that draw it.
Historically, state legislatures have drawn those maps, and that's where gerrymandering comes in. The party in power can draw the map in a way that will make it easier for its party members to win in coming elections. Imagine a pizza with olives and tomatoes. There are all sorts of creative ways to cut up the pizza. Some ways would leave each piece looking pretty much 50-50, olive-tomato. Other slicings might cluster all the olives on one piece. Or the opposite, leave hardly any olives at all. Now imagine the olives are Democrats and the tomatoes are Republican, or vice versa. That's gerrymandering.
And that's a huge problem for our democracy.
That's Michael Lee. He's a redistricting expert at NYU's Brennan Center for Justice.
By no means are the Rocky Mountains the worst states, but the problem of gerrymandering is one that has been growing and is one that is getting worse.
Lee says when state legislatures are in charge of drawing the district maps, it's kind of like letting the fox design the henhouse.
It's sort of counter to the vision of how most people think that democracy should work. You should be able to throw the rascals out, and unfortunately, the rascals have engineered it so they never get thrown out.
And this year, Colorado and Utah are part of a bigger trend to change that setup. Next month, voters in both states will decide if they're going to take the map drawing power out of the hands of legislators and put it into the hands of regular citizens. In Utah, lawmakers from both sides of the aisle would choose those people. Colorado's plan is more extreme, as this ad from the group Fair Maps Colorado explains.
No lobbyists, no politicians, gerrymandering banned.
In Colorado, retired judges would choose some of the people to put on the commission. The others would be chosen at random from a pool of applicants. The combined group would be equal parts Republican, Democrat, and independent.
Yes, that's essentially how it works.
Kent Theory is one of the architects behind Colorado's move.
If we pass this, we will probably have, unambiguously, the most thoughtful gerrymandering reform initiative in America.
That may be an exaggeration. So I asked Michael Lee, will these measures in Utah and Colorado prevent gerrymandering in those states?
Yes. If they pass, they will be models for states around the country.
Most importantly, he says, both measures would make partisan gerrymandering illegal. Right now, it isn't.
The Supreme Court has deadlocked on the issue repeatedly, and so right now there really isn't a way to go into court and say this map is unfair, this map is a partisan gerrymander.
Both of these measures would make that possible. So even if an evil mastermind found a way to game the system and get those regular citizens to gerrymander, voters would have a way to fight back.
Yes, that's huge. The ability to go to court is absolutely huge, and it's part of a growing trend.
One that's especially relevant right now. The 2020 census is right around the corner, and when those results come back, it'll be time to draw new maps. For Here and Now, I'm Ray Ellen Bischel.
And Ray Ellen's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau. Well, here in Florida, we're going to convene a political roundtable to hear about the contentious governor's race in this state. It's one of the most watched races in the country. We'll also hear how the incoming governor gets to pick three new state Supreme Court judges. Some say that'll be the most important thing that governor can do. And are you a construction worker? Florida is looking for you. More from Florida today, Here and Now. One of the hottest races in the country got a little more heated yesterday. The Tampa Bay Times reporting that a text shows the Democratic candidate for governor, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum, was given free tickets to the Broadway show Hamilton as a gift from an FBI agent posing as a developer, something Gillum still fiercely denies. He is one of the breakout stars of this election season, leading the Republican candidate, former congressman and Iraq War vet, and President Trump favorite Ron DeSantis, by as many as 12 points in the polling. The two had a contentious two-hour debate on CNN on Sunday, and we invited both men to sit down with us this week. Only Gillum accepted. He is the first African-American Democratic gubernatorial candidate in Florida's history, probably its most progressive. He supports hiking the state's corporate tax rate to fund education, raising the minimum wage, and he is for a single-payer healthcare system. We'll have more in a minute on the new reporting on alleged gifts to Gillum, again, something he denies, and what he told us about the accusations. But first, we started our conversation with him this week on his stand on Medicare for All.
I said I've endorsed Medicare for All at the federal level, and I encourage them to move diligently to get that done. Florida could not go there alone. We would need a federal solution here, and at the very least, we would need a consort of states coming together to negotiate prescription drugs and others on behalf of its citizens. And so what is within my power, however, is to expand Medicaid, which is what we've committed to doing for over 800,000 of the most medically needy people in my state. Right now, Republicans have refused to expand Medicaid for that group, costing this state $6 billion that we could bring down from the federal government that right now is being given away to other states. While we've got one in five people in my state going to emergency rooms to access health care, that's unacceptable. I mean, Mr. DeSantis said that to a cancer patient when asked how she was supposed to get access to health care, he said you could always go to an emergency room. That response, in my opinion, is disqualifying for anyone running for governor of the state of Florida.
Let's talk about crime. You are the mayor of Tallahassee, which is the biggest city in Leon County.
That's right.
Which has the highest crime rate in the state. We were traveling, and a young African-American who was also coming to Tallahassee as we were flying here said to us, you know, I think this is a problem. He's for DeSantis.
And Tallahassee is the eighth largest city in the state of Florida, and we're 28th in crime. My city is experiencing a five-year low in our crime rate. Mr. DeSantis described our community as one where people are sheltering themselves in homes and avoiding the streets. And he clearly has never spent any time in Tallahassee. Regular, everyday working people in my state recognize that communities are going to have crime. They know that. The question is, what do communities do about it? And what we've done about it in my city is we've hired 50 new law enforcement officers over the past 4 years. We've brought down our crime rate. We've instituted restorative justice practices, created reentry programs so that folks who are returning citizens to our community get the opportunity to reenter society and have dignity around their work. This categorization of a high, lawless, this is Trumpian politics. It is not based in reality.
I want to ask you about President Trump.
Yeah.
In your debate with Ron DeSantis, you said he was a stooge for the president. You made no bones about how you felt about President Trump and his looseness with
absence
facts.
Of leadership.
Well, an absence of leadership, as you put it. President Trump's polling numbers, they have bumped up. Is it maybe a mistake in a state like Florida to call your opponent a stooge? First of all, that's, you know, the kind of language that we expect from others.
Well, I'll tell you, I will take my chances. I am sick to my stomach at the national, at the state, at the local level, people normalizing the behavior that comes out of Washington, D.C. I refuse to do it. I'm teaching my kids what it means to the golden rule to treat people like you want to be treated. Our president goes around making fun of handicapped individuals, referring to women in all kinds of vile ways, objectifying women. And I have a daughter. I'm prepared to take my chances calling the president out for what I believe is completely inappropriate behavior. And Mr. DeSantis, he is sucking up to the president. He does consider himself an apprentice to Donald Trump. If we're ever going to restore decency and common sense to our body politic, more people have to join me in decrying this kind of divisive, racist, xenophobic, and sexist language out. I'm never going to make apologies for trying to create a kind of society and a kind of community where my kids will be proud to grow up in.
As Ron DeSantis says, if you're this strongly speaking out against the president as governor, how do you then work with the Trump administration? How do you get the money you need for the environmental plans that you have for the state?
Unfortunately for Mr. DeSantis, this is not Russia. We don't bow down to the president. We work with. Take, for instance, under Governor Rick Scott. He disagreed vehemently with President Obama. President Obama, in spite of that vehement disagreement, tried to send the state of Florida $2.8 billion to build high-speed rail. Governor Rick Scott said, no, thank you. We don't believe in Obama stimulus money. As much as I disagree with the conduct and the qualifications of this president, and if he tries to send Florida $2.8 billion, I'm going to take that money and I'm going to put that money to work for everyday Floridians. When I'm governor, my differences aside from the president, he's going to find a willing partner in me who's willing to help him on infrastructure, help on transportation. Rick Scott and I, who, again, don't agree on a lot politically, during this last storm, Hurricane Michael, we spoke every day on the phone.
Talk a little bit about the environment, which has been hammering your region. Your opponent, DeSantis, is now positioning himself as a Ted Roosevelt conservationist. He says he wants to build reservoirs to restore water flow and prevent those toxic algae blooms. He supports a ban on fracking, drilling off the coast. Certainly different from your Republican sitting governor, Scott.
My opponent can say anything he wants to in an election year, but I have to measure him by his 6 years in Congress. Someone who voted to undermine the Environmental Protection Agency. Someone who voted against the Clean Water Act 33 times. As the mayor of Florida's capital city, we broke ground on a 120-acre solar farm, tripling the amount of solar energy that we produce. And the city of Tallahassee, where we sit above the Florida and aquifer, and where we noticed through our spray field operations that we were contributing to higher nitrate levels in Wakulla Springs, we took the necessary steps to begin treating that water at the near tertiary level, almost potable level, to reduce the number of nitrates going into our groundwater. When we get elected governor, we're going to have a governor who believes in science. Put some teeth back into our Department of Environmental Protection, where we have deregulated across that agency, allowing the biggest polluters to write their own rules.
Is there going to come a point where people like you have to say to people, we can't afford to have you wiped out time after time?
Well, listen, you go to a issue that is going to be hugely at the top of our agenda. We recognize that we are highly susceptible to the impacts of global warming and sea level rise. And so we've got to start building a more resilient state. And yes, that in some cases will mean that there are parts of our state where we're not going to be able to continue to allow growth to take place. Already, insurance and actuarial studies are showing some of these areas that are going to be underwater.
That's Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee, Democratic gubernatorial candidate here in Florida. Mayor Gillum, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Of course. Take care.
Part of our talk with Andrew Gillum this past Monday. And as we said, yesterday, the Tampa Bay Times reported that a text from Gillum's old friend and lobbyist Adam Corey shows that a man they both thought was a developer had Broadway tickets for Gillum and others, including Gillum's brother. Now, the text from Corey reads, "Mike Miller and the crew have tickets for us for Hamilton tonight." Gillum replies, awesome news about Hamilton. Mike Miller turned out to be an FBI agent, part of an undercover investigation into corruption, not focusing on Gillum. Gillum says his brother handed him the ticket. He assumed his brother paid for it. Here's what he told us in our conversation. Tell us about the FBI investigation. According to the New York Times, I'm just going to synopsize it, there was a lobbyist friend of yours that was actually a friend, as many of your friends are, from your student government days in college. This is Adam Corey, who introduced you to men who identified themselves as out-of-town developers. They want to invest in property. They turned out to be FBI agents working undercover to investigate community redevelopment agency, possible corruption. You've said they told you that you are not their target, but before you knew who they were, you made two personal trips with your old friend, Adam Corey, one to Costa Rica. There's questions about whether or not you and your wife paid your share of a home there. You say you did. And then another trip to New York where you've said your younger brother bought you tickets to see Hamilton.
Yeah.
Do you stand by that, that your brother gave you the tickets?
I absolutely stand by that.
Yeah.
Now, I realize that my opponents have tried to seize on this in some way to make me look less than above board. But as I have said repeatedly, one, I am a adult working man who is married to my wife, who is a working woman, and we don't take free trips from anybody. We pay our own way. I am not the subject of an FBI investigation, and there is no evidence to suggest that that is true. Neither is my city. But what this fits into is a narrative that my opponents would love to suggest that somehow people like me don't pay our fair share. And I take great issue with the suggestion that people like me somehow take free things that we didn't pay for and that we didn't earn.
Again, part of our conversation with Florida's Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Andrew Gillum. We invited his Republican opponent, Ron DeSantis, to speak with us as well, but he declined. Elsewhere in the program, how is Gillum's explanation about that Hamilton ticket playing with voters? But meantime, Gillum and DeSantis are scheduled to debate again tonight at Broward College in Davie, Florida. It will probably be well worth watching.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hurricane Willa weakened to a tropical depression as it moved inland over west central Mexico this morning, but it could bring extreme weather to parts of the U.S. as it crosses the border. Jeff Huffman is director and chief meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Hi, Jeff.
Oh, good afternoon, Jeremy.
Now, this storm was a Category 5 storm on Monday. When it hit, it had weakened. How powerful was it?
Certainly a top storm in terms of its intensity. And, of course, landfall there in Mexico was not good news, but it has dissipated entirely over the mountains. So that is good news. But certainly, I think in terms of the pressure to fall, once again, it was in the top five in the Pacific. Of course, the specialist will be analyzing the exact numbers that when it came ashore based on some of the damage.
So when it crosses into the U.S., I guess the first place it will hit is Texas, and a lot of rain is expected.
Yeah, it's no longer a tropical system per se, but there's this remnant pool of moisture that's moving into Texas. That's actually occurring today. So a lot of rain for areas that don't need it, especially in the hill country there in Texas. But also more rain will be upstream from this as well as it meets up with a little cold front coming in from the central U.S. An area of low pressure is expected to develop in the Gulf. And we're preparing for some significant rain in the panhandle in Florida. Obviously, the recovery efforts continue there from Hurricane Michael, and this will continue up to the northeast.
And tell us about that. What is expected for the northeast? Because this looks, as you look at the forecast for the northeastern part of the United States, it looks like it's going to be a pretty significant storm, even a nor'easter.
Yeah, it could be. Remember, a nor'easter is not necessarily a term for just a snowstorm in New England. It has to do with the pressure falls and the strength of the system and that northeast wind, and that will be intense. The good news is for Floridians and the Carolinians that are recovering from both Florence and Michael and the rainfall, it's going to be a quick-moving system. So rainfall is going to be manageable there. But the storm may slow down in the Mid-Atlantic states and northeast, so along the coast, some very heavy rain, possibly some inland flooding. And, Jeremy, the wind speeds could be close to hurricane force right along the coast, especially up in New England and especially around Cape Cod. Of course, a lot still to determine on the track and the intensity, but this will be a pretty powerful nor'easter, and it's a little early in the fall season for such a strong event.
Well, and let's talk about the fact that this is not an Atlantic storm. A lot of the storms we talked to you about are coming out of the Atlantic. This is a Pacific hurricane that is making its way to the Atlantic, but this has been an unusually active hurricane season in the Pacific.
It has been, and also now a little bit on the unusual side in the Atlantic. We're pacing above normal for numbers. Remember, this time of year, I think if you remember Hurricane Sandy, it got caught up in this jet stream, and that happens later in the fall. The westerly winds, the mid-latitude winds, are a little stronger, and they can sometimes dive in and pick up tropical entities and push them along. Remember, tropical systems in the subtropics and the tropics like to move east to west or right to left on a satellite image, but when they get north of a certain latitude, the westerly winds pick them up. And in this case, those westerly winds from the Pacific pushing it all the way into New England this weekend.
And we're here in late October at this point. Is there much time left in the hurricane season, just briefly?
It officially ends in late November, but we normally see a dramatic decrease in activity around this time of year. Still got to keep an eye on a couple of disturbances, but things are winding down.
And then we can start talking to you about winter storms. Jeff Huffman, Director and Chief Meteorologist of the Florida Public Radio Emergency Network. Thanks as always.
My pleasure.
I'm Robin Young at WFSU in Tallahassee, Florida today. Early voting is underway here. As usual, the state has some exciting races to watch. We've talked about the governor's race between the Democrat Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and the Republican former Congressman Ron DeSantis. There's a tight race as well for a Senate seat. Not on the ballot, but on people's minds, Donald Trump and a hurricane. Here's some of what we're hearing.
For Governor Andrew Gillum. Because he is a Democrat and the Republicans need to be put in their place.
I'm a Republican, so I'm going to be voting right now for the Republican candidates probably across the boards.
I agree with Trump for this moment. I think he do a good job for this country.
Right now, you know, I think they need to focus on health care.
This music always makes me feel so patriotic. That's Wendy Velasquez in Miami. Also with her in Miami there, Rosie Patella, Jacob Bernstein, and Alexander Trujillo. Healthcare, President Trump. Can the sitting governor, the Republican Rick Scott, unseat longtime Senator Bill Nelson? There's a lot going on, so let's convene our Florida Politics Roundtable to talk about it all. Enrique Acevedo, an anchor for Univision, special correspondent for Fusion, joins us from WLRN in Miami. Hi, Enrique.
Hi, Robin.
I'm getting closer to you. I'm in your state.
I'm glad.
And with me here in Tallahassee, Ryan Daly, a reporter for WFSU. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, Robin. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we want to start with you because we want to get to that governor's race. The Democrat, Andrew Gillum, as we've said, has been fending off these charges that he took tickets. Hamilton makes it into this race. And his share of a vacation that a couple's friends took, just one trip, that he took these as gifts from developers that turned out to be an FBI agent in an ethics commission investigation. He is not the subject of that investigation. Now, the Tampa Bay Times yesterday broke the story of a text in which Gillum's friend, a lobbyist, told him about this Hamilton ticket that this developer had for them. Gillum responds, awesome. But he is insisting, even today, he thought his brother paid for that ticket. Is this going to hurt? Is this sticking? He is far ahead of DeSantis in some polling.
Right. Yeah. I think it's important to remember that this is part of that state ethics board investigation. Mm-hmm. I talked with Gillum's lawyer, Barry Richard, back in September, who said he doesn't expect this investigation to be concluded by the time people have gone to the polls anyway. Mm-hmm. So I think what it's all going to hinge on, what it's all going to come down to, and you'll see this tonight in the gubernatorial debate here in Florida,
yeah,
that it's going to come down to how Andrew Gillum answers these questions. I mean, almost undoubtedly, the DeSantis camp is going to try to use this to point to dishonesty, to inconsistencies in the story. Mm-hmm. I think if you are on the Gillum team, you are hoping that he sticks with his story. Again, it's going to come down to how he answers those questions tonight.
And it's really an important race because Gillum could – I think he's like the third – Democratic African-American candidate for governor here. He would be only the third in the country, something like that. And he is – they couldn't be more different. He's a progressive. Let's hear DeSantis on Fox News earlier this month.
You know, I have a positive relationship with the president and key people in the administration. Florida has a lot of needs from our military footprint, our transportation, our water resources, which has been a big problem here. And we need to work constructively with the federal government. Andrew Gillum is running on impeaching Donald Trump. I don't know what for, but I don't think he's going to be able to do anything productively with the federal government. And I will be able to do that.
And Ryan, so how is President Trump playing out in this race?
Well, I mean, I think you need to look no further than the Florida Republican primary to get a sense of how Trump affects races here in the state. You could say DeSantis got the Trump bump, so to speak. In fact, there's a pretty good soundbite of Trump saying, I'm slightly paraphrasing here, but I sent a tweet and bing, bing, DeSantis was up by, however many points. And I was actually downtown where the Gillum campaign was awaiting their primary night results. The Republican primary was decided well before the Democratic primary that was coming down to the wire. So I think anytime, we've seen that President Trump can be a wild card stepping into races, tweeting support for a candidate.
Well, Enrique Acevedo, let me bring you in here because the president also has pulled a wild card in these couple of weeks leading up to November 6 elections. And that's this, as he calls it, the caravan of some say refugees, some say undocumented immigrants making their way through Mexico to the U.S. border. They are going something like 25 miles a day. At this rate, they will not even reach that border till December, the number who reach it. But the president has been positioning this as, almost an attack on the border. How's that resonating where you are in Miami?
And he's been able also to position this as an attack on Democrats, blaming them for what's happening with the caravan and saying they're all for open borders. I think this is one of those, it's certainly a politically charged caravan at a very convenient time for the president. It puts the issue of immigration front and center, which it already was, to be honest, in this election, along with healthcare and the economy. I do think it could be one of those X factors coming into the election, Robin, and we'll really see the impact, all the coverage and all the attention this caravan has had in the last couple of days and that it will have in the run-up to the midterm election. We'll see that on voting day. Depending on the turnout, both parties, I think, agree this is a turnout election.
Well, and let's be clear. This is a caravan that reportedly was organized by churches. And it happens quite often. It's just that this one has come up on the radar. And the last one that was of this size, a group of people, organized again by churches to try to seek refugee status in the United States. In the last caravan that got so much attention, CNN is reporting that just three people were accepted into the country. So there is that. But I just to underscore this, Enrique, we people, Latino, Hispanic voters do not all vote in a block. You will have people who will be coming from the same countries who will resent people who are coming across the border. And we've been talking to construction workers or builders who are desperate for some of those people they're seeing on the screen to come work here.
And that's an excellent point. And Florida is a great example, Robin. You see the Cuban American community, traditionally very conservative, very pro-Republican. They have been very pro-Trump. Trump won the state in 2016. Now you have Puerto Ricans, many of them who were already in Florida before Maria, but all the Hurricane Maria, all the Puerto Ricans that have since coming to Florida and that are some of them have re-registered to be part of this midterm election, and they will certainly play a role in the result for the governor race and the Senate race. So it's very interesting. And yes, the Latino community is not a monolithic community, different interests and different agendas.
I want to turn to the Senate race. The Democrat Bill Nelson, the incumbent, has held the seat since 2001. But some polling shows that sitting Governor Scott has a shot. The two candidates had a debate earlier this month on Telemundo 51. Let's listen to a little of that. First, Governor Scott.
Senator Nelson and Andrew Gillum will kill the economy. They like high taxes. Andrew Gillum has said he wants to raise taxes 40%. Senator Nelson has voted for tax increases or higher taxes over 300 times.
And here's Senator Nelson responding.
Well, the governor keeps coming out with one whopper after another. Apparently, you never got your mouth washed out with soap after telling a lie, because you keep on going on every part of my record.
Ryan Daly from WFSU here in Tallahassee, always colorful. But who's got the edge here? And especially with the hurricane that just hit, every time I turn the TV on, I see Governor Scott in a little cap, you know, visiting, you know, some terrible, you know, disaster where a school's roof has been ripped off. I mean, he is seemingly everywhere. So who's got the edge here?
Yeah, I mean, there was the latest Quinnipiac poll released, I think, yesterday had Nelson's lead at about 7 points. I mean, hurricane recovery, obviously inherently political. I think Rick Scott being the governor, he had the advantage in visibility in the response to Hurricane Michael. But Senator Bill Nelson, I think to his credit, he visited emergency operations centers in Bay County here in Tallahassee, visited rural counties and raised concerns about their abilities to recover. I don't think that the hurricane response gave Scott much of a discernible boost. Yeah. I think Nelson is holding that lead right now.
Well, that's Ryan Daly here at WFSU. Enrique Acevedo, anchor for Univision there in Miami. We will continue to watch what's always fascinating politics in Florida. Thanks for helping us do that, guys.
Thank you.
A video of a British diver swimming through a soup of plastic bags and food wrappers off the coasts of Bali, Indonesia, went viral earlier this year and sparked anger and calls for action to tackle ocean pollution. Indonesia is the world's second largest source of marine plastic waste after China. Reporter Maria Bakalapalo traveled to Bali to find out more about the problem and efforts to reduce plastic use and pollution.
It's early morning on Sabah Beach on Bali's east coast. Around 50 people in yellow I'm a Trash Hero t-shirts comb the coastline. Organizing them is Wayan Aksara of Trash Hero Indonesia, a community group with 38 chapters across the island nation. In 1 year alone, the volunteers have collected 15 metric tons of plastic trash. But Aksara knows that picking up trash will not solve the problem.
The more important is we educate the people how they manage their trash, and then the important thing is how to stop plastic.
Indonesia currently uses a whopping 9.8 billion plastic bags per year, according to the country's Director General of Waste Management. Many of these bags end up in the country's rivers and oceans. Record tourism in Bali is only compounding the problem, but Indonesia has committed to cut its plastic waste by 70% within the next 7 years by developing new industries that use biodegradable materials, as well as public education and a tax on plastic bags. Once all the volunteers leave, Wayan Aksara heads over to see his friend, Nyoman Adi Artana, at his plastic bottle packing plant. This is where the trash heroes send their empty bottles for recycling. Adi Artana uses a hydraulic press to compact 5,000 bottles into a roughly 1 cubic meter bale weighing around 300 pounds. The bales are then loaded onto trucks to be recycled in Java. On an average day, they load 3 trucks. For every bale, Artana makes approximately $4.
There's not a lot of money to make this kind of thing because plastic, not sexy business. I choose plastic because I know not many people willing to do this. If you want to make more money about the rubbish, you have to choose metal.
Indonesia's government says it will spend $1 billion to reduce plastic pollution over the coming decade. Nyoman Adi Artana wants to be a role model and hopes to see locals practice better recycling.
Everybody knows plastic cannot be recycling except by the earth. If they stay in the earth, it can stay more than 100 years. So we have to take it, bring it to somewhere and recycle it, rather than let it stay in the earth, in the land.
A company in Bali called Avani Eco is trying to make a difference at the production end of the equation. They are making products using bioplastics, materials made from plants or bacterial processes. Bioplastics are biodegradable as well as sustainable. Seaweed is one of the most promising materials. Another is the root vegetable cassava. Kevin Kumala, co-founder and CEO of Avani Eco, is leading the way in converting cassava into plastic bags and straws. His company also turns sugarcane fiber into takeaway containers.
Here in Indonesia, we're growing about 25.2 million tons of cassava annually, in which it means that when it comes to the commodity price, cassava is the most economical commodity available in the country.
The Avani Eco Hub was founded in 2014 and now has 95 employees and 20 machines, giving them the capability to produce up to 40 metric tons of cassava bags per month. Avani's bioplastic products use mostly low-value, inedible, and what would otherwise be discarded byproducts from the food industry. There are some concerns, though, about pressures on land use if crops are grown to feed into the bioplastic supply chain. At the Bali factory, they are producing their I'm Not Plastic cassava bags. The cost of the cassava bags is 50% more than regular plastic bags. But Kevin Kumala says they are still in the early stages of scaling up their output. The cost will go down with increased demand and better production techniques. And with Avani Eco and over 100 bio-based companies around the world competing in this growing market, Kumala believes Indonesia can reach those ambitious goals it has set for itself.
I truly believe 5 years, 10 years down the line, I really believe that the utilization of plastic is going to be much, much smaller than what it is today. The utilization of plastic will drop, and I think as much as 70, even 80%, 10 years down the road.
As more cities and countries reduce and even ban the use of some plastics, including bags and straws, the bioplastic industry's biggest challenge may one day be keeping up with the demand. For Here and Now, I'm Maria Bakalapolo.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young at WFSU in Tallahassee. It's Here and Now.